This is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, global financial markets tumble. The French Legion of Honor is bestowed on four train attack heroes. Lessons learned 10 years after Hurricane Katrina. A brand new artistic look for the American flag.
So it's a delicate balance of highlighting what is best in America, American ideals, and yet artists should feel perfectly free to express those times in our history where we've fallen short of those ideals.
These stories are more just ahead. I'm Ray Kugel. Concerns over China's faltering economy pushed down stock and oil prices around the world on Monday. U.S. stock markets plunged at the open, with the Dow Jones Industrials Average off almost 5% in the first few minutes of trading. After a day of wild swings in stock prices, U.S. indexes were down 3.6% or more at the close of trading. Asian and European stock indexes fell 4% or more. Prices for many commodities also declined, with the price of crude oil off by more than 4% to the lowest price in more than 6 years. International Edition's Jim Stevenson spoke with VOA's senior economics correspondent Jim Randall about the sharp downturn on the world's markets.
The thing is that corrections are sort of an ordinary part of economic life. They seem to happen every year or so, and a bunch of them have happened since they started keeping track of such things. And the stock market gets, you know, it gets frothy. It gets the valuation of these companies gets larger than their real value. It gets larger than their fundamentals. I mean, a company's value is the gizmos, the stock, the inventory, and the creativity of its people and its patents and the goodwill of its customers, all those kinds of things. Sometimes when there's a lot of money chasing a finite number of companies, they kind of get bid up, they kind of get inflated, and they kind of get overdone. And this is supposedly a correction of that. That's why they call it a correction. And these happen from time to time. And if, when it's 10%, they call it a correction. Now, why it's not 20% or 5% or 7.83%, I have no idea. But 10%, they call it a correction.
A lot of people have gotten used to the markets, at least here in the United States, going up for quite some time. The correction hasn't really taken place on what some would call a regular basis.
It's been 1,000 days or about 3 years since the last one, apparently. Mm. And that we've got a lot of analysts saying, well, you know, we're overdue. It's time that this should happen.
Overall, is a correction a healthy thing?
Well, some say yes, because if the values of the of stocks get out of touch with the underlying economic realities, yeah, you need to fix that. There's a process called price discovery, and investors say, oh, I'll pay this much for that good or that service, and I'll pay, somebody else says, I'll pay a different price, and back and forth and back, and they haggle back and forth. Eventually, they figure out what's a reasonable price, what's a price that they're willing to pay, and that's what's happening.
The Chinese markets continue to take a pounding day after day. They are just plummeting.
That's a crisis of confidence and faith, because some investors have expressed skepticism about how accurate the Chinese official statistics are. They apparently, some people don't trust them, and they're wondering if, oh, gee, if they admit that this much is wrong, there's probably a lot more. They fear that the statistics overstate the solidity of the economy, and they're distrustful. And whether that's right or not is another question for another day, but it's clear that they are concerned.
There are those who would say that the U.S. economy is on much more of a sound footing. Why would U.S. stocks react so sharply to the big drops in China?
Well, that's an excellent question, because U.S. exports to China are something like 0.7% of the U.S. GDP. Now, suppose U.S. exports to China went to zero. That's not going to happen, but just say it did, right? Mm-hmm. Okay, that would be a dent in the U.S. economy. That would be annoying, but it's not catastrophic. U.S. exports to the entire developing world are 2.5% of the U.S. GDP. If all of those exports went away, which is never going to happen, it would basically end U.S. growth for the year. Well, that would be a problem, but it's not a catastrophe. So perhaps the market is overreacting, or perhaps the market was just so inflated that this is a necessary change.
VOA senior economics correspondent Jim Randall speaking with International Edition's Jim Stevenson. Turning now to social media reaction on the global sell-off, International Edition's G. Abby Lee is here to tell us what the Twitter world is saying. Hi, G.
Hello, Ray. Let's begin with a trending hashtag. Hashtag Black Monday was a worldwide trending hashtag referring to the Chinese market's biggest one-day nosedive in 8 years. You know the term Black Monday is quite confusing for some people because the markets are in the red. As you know, profits are usually shown in black ink. So in many languages, being in the black means you're making a profit. That's why here in the States we have a day called Black Friday, when retailers have a huge sale after Thanksgiving and just rake in the money. Being in the red, on the other hand, means you're losing money.
Well, maybe you can straighten out this quandary. Why do we call it Black Monday?
Great question. The terminology goes way back, a flashback to October 1987, when stock markets around the world crashed. And just like today, it began in Asia and spread west to Europe and the United States. So unlike in Black Friday, the Black in Black Monday describes the bleak financial situation.
I kind of get that, G. Now, How popular was that hashtag?
I looked that up on the Topsy Analytics website, and more than 75,000 tweets used that hashtag during the last 24 hours. Other popular hashtags related to the meltdown are hashtag Wall Street and hashtag Dow Jones.
What are some Twitter accounts writing about the situation?
Ray, many media accounts have been tweeting about Black Monday. But surprisingly, the Treasury Department at U.S. Treasury didn't tweet about it at all. And although White House Press Secretary Josh Earnest told reporters that President Obama was briefed about the situation, he didn't tweet about it. Ray?
Social media reporter G. Abby Lee. And you can follow her on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. That's JEEABBEYLEE. And you can also comment on our website at www.voanews.com. This is VOA.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
Hi, I'm Larry London, and I'm the host of Border Crossings, inviting you to join me for one of the best hours of request music possible on the radio. We've got all your favorite songs by your favorite singers. You tell us what to play. It's requests and dedications, and it happens every weekday right here on The Voice of America.
This is VOA's International Edition. With every passing day, the number of people migrating from both Africa and the Middle East headed toward Europe gets larger. Many countries are straining to respond to this mass movement of humanity. Some are simply packing and shipping migrants and depositing them on the borders of other countries. International Edition's Jeffrey Young spoke with Joel Millman, press officer with the International Organization for Migration in Geneva, to get a sense of how massive this migration is and what it is doing to Europe.
Things that are really impacting people in traditional societies in places like North Africa and Central Africa and, of course, the Middle East, they're combining to create quite a lot of ferment, and we're seeing two big waves, as you suggested, converging on Europe. It's been going on for a few years now, and this year is particularly busy. But there's quite a lot of armed conflict across Africa. I mean, Eritrea considers itself at war with Ethiopia, even after all these years. And they've used that to justify a lot of repressive measures that are causing a lot of people to migrate from that country. Certainly, the world community treats Eritrean migrants as refugees and as war victims, even though there's not a war you hear very much about. Then, of course, you have Syria and Libya, which are civil wars that are absolutely chaotic. People couldn't even name the combatants in either of those places, much less which side the U.S. or the Europe would favor. These are just anarchistic kind of unravelings that are going on in both those societies after a period of dictatorship. But to a lesser degree, that's happening in places elsewhere across the continent. I mean, the Congo, Nigeria with Boko Haram, Mali has had conflicts. So we wouldn't restrict it just to the wars people have heard of. There's plenty of violence that people are fleeing all over the region.
One thing that we've seen in recent days in the Balkans is the use of violence by Macedonian authorities. Also, packing trains at the border with Greece and sending the trains on to Serbia, basically to transport and unload the problem on somebody else's border. Any reflection?
Well, I mean, this is something that Europe's been grappling with now for as long as I've been at IOM. It's a problem of different treaties affecting different groups of countries. You know, the ones that are EU members found an easy passage up to France, Switzerland, Austria, countries that border Italy. That made a difference. But in general, what's happening you're seeing in the Balkans and in the eastern part of the Mediterranean is that a huge population of mostly Syrian migrants have landed in the Greek islands this year, and Greece does not share a border with EU members, with fellow EU members. So the transit out of Greece to the destination a lot of these migrants are hoping to get to, which is Central Europe, Germany particularly, and Scandinavia, is difficult for them. So they're going through countries that don't recognize the right of passage for those people who come from another European country. But it's not new with Macedonia and Greece. I mean, Hungary went through this with Serbia earlier this year. For them, it was a huge crisis. And there's also movement from Ukraine and Belarus and Moldova and places that are even east of what we think of as the core EU countries. So it's kind of across Europe there's a groping towards what's going to be a unified migration strategy, and it's being imposed because the numbers of migrants are just so great they have got to come up with a new way to manage this.
Joel Millman, press officer with the International Organization for Migration in Geneva, speaking with International Edition's Jeffrey Young. French President François Hollande bestowed the Legion of Honor, France's highest decoration, on three Americans and a Briton who subdued a heavily armed gunman aboard a high-speed train last Friday. At a ceremony in Paris Monday, Mr. Hollande pinned medals on the chests of American Spencer Stone, Alec Scarlatos, and Anthony Sadler, and Britain's Chris Norman. The French leader said their actions in the face of terror provided a message of courage, solidarity, and hope. International Edition Susan Yaki spoke with reporter Lisa Bryant in Paris about the ceremony.
It was very emotional to a certain extent, and I think that there was a lot of pride by both on the part of both the French and the Americans. President François Hollande handed the highest award, the Legion of Honor, to the three Americans and the Briton, who together tackled down the assailant on the train to Paris. He talked a lot about, you know, the valor, the courage that was displayed by the passengers, and he talked about how proud France was. And you know, it was definitely a great moment in terms of French-American relations, which haven't always been so great.
And how do the French people feel about these four? It seems like they're treating them like great, great heroes.
Yep, that's exactly what they're saying. I've done some vox pops and talked to people on the street and in the train station of the Gare du Nord, where you know the Talis train was supposed to have arrived, and that's exactly the words that were used by quite a few French and a few American and international passengers. They feel that that the four saved the day.
And they've also heard from President Obama, so they're getting gratitude all around. I've seen them on TV. They were just beaming.
Yes, they were. And I also saw them, a lot of reporters were at the U.S. Embassy yesterday, and the three Americans were basically talking and explaining their experience, which they've also done on French and American TV. And you know, one of them, obviously, Spencer Stone has a cast, and his arm is in a sling because he's the one who really, really tackled this best suspect to the ground. But he, you know, all four of them were beaming and clearly very happy.
Reporter Lisa Bryant in Paris speaking with my colleague Susan Yaki. The gunman's been identified as Ayoub El-Khazani, a 25-year-old Moroccan. French counterterrorism officials continue to question Khazani, known to intelligence services in three countries, for links to radical Islam and who may have traveled to Syria. His lawyer maintains that Khazani is dumbfounded by the terrorism allegations, saying his client only intended to rob passengers. It was Independence Day in Ukraine Monday, celebrations held to mark the event that heralded the collapse of the Soviet Union. VOA's Daniel Scharf has details from Moscow.
Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko on Monday said the next year would be one of struggle against Russia's efforts to undermine his country. Speaking in Kiev during celebrations marking Ukraine's independence, he accused Russia of sending more troops and weapons across the border. We have to understand that any wrong step could be the last, he said. The war for independence is still going on, and victory is possible only through combined efforts of defense, diplomatic pressure, and political responsibility. The Kremlin denies giving military support for pro-Russia rebels in Ukraine's east, despite mounting evidence. Mr. Poroshenko said Ukraine's fight for independence would continue for decades. Dmitry Trenin is director of the Carnegie Moscow Center.
To a lot of people in Ukraine, what's happening is a rebellion which is backed by Russia. And in that sense, Poroshenko is fighting for complete independence from Russia.
Ukraine's declaration of independence on August 24, 1991, and referendum a few months later, heralded the breakup of the Soviet Union. But Trenin says it was only in the late 90s that the Kremlin elite and Russian people accepted the idea of Ukraine as an independent state.
The Ukrainian referendum back in 1991 essentially mixed all remaining illusions about preserving some kind of a union, a close union of former Soviet republics. And basically, it told the Russians that from now on, they have to be on their own.
Trenin says Russia's annexation of Crimea last year was a move the Kremlin long planned to make if it found itself losing influence in Ukraine to the West. The popular uprising that saw the ouster of Russia-backed Ukrainian President Viktor Yanukovych was seen by the Kremlin as the final straw. Daniel Scherf, VOA News, Moscow.
Still to come, a new look at America's stars and stripes. This is VOA.
This is Greenbee for a healthier planet.
How is this related to this? Both coffee and these birds come from the same tropical regions. But Robert Rice of the Smithsonian's Migratory Bird Center says growing conventional sun-grown coffee can change that lush tropical landscape because it doesn't provide much in the way of habitat or biodiversity. Shade-grown coffee, on the other hand, helps preserve the environment.
Some of the birds that are frequenting and making use of shade-grown coffee are this group called wood warblers.
So the Migratory Bird Center developed a bird-friendly certification.
Any of the major organic certification agencies have someone who has been trained by us to evaluate the shade.
Bird-friendly coffee now extends to more than 5,500 hectares, including where coffee first originated.
The shade actually in Ethiopia is great. Almost any coffee in Ethiopia is going to qualify as bird-friendly.
So coffee is for the birds. I'm Rebecca Ward for VOA's Green Beat.
You're listening to VOA's International Edition, coming to you from Washington. It was 10 years ago that Hurricane Katrina slammed into the southern U.S. state of Louisiana, killing 1,800 people, displacing more than 1 million others and causing $110 billion in damage. An economics professor says the lessons learned from Katrina should be applied elsewhere in the world, where tens of millions of people live in coastal areas, many at risk. VOA's Joe DiCapua explains.
About 60 million poor people live in low elevation zones, 10 meters or less above sea level. It means they're particularly vulnerable to large storms and rising seas. They're concentrated in 15 countries: Nigeria, Senegal, Mozambique, India, Bangladesh, Myanmar, and Cambodia, as well as Pakistan, Iraq, Brazil, China, Indonesia, the Philippines, Vietnam, and Thailand. About 2.5 billion people live within 100 kilometers of the coast. Most are in developing countries. In 2005, Hurricane Katrina wreaked havoc not only on Louisiana, but along much of the Gulf of Mexico. University of Wyoming professor Edward Barbier says Katrina showed how important it is to have a coastal management strategy. He says it addresses two types of impacts.
One type of impact is the short-term natural disasters that we see routinely, such as hurricanes, storm surges, and so forth. And the second is the long-term consequences of climate change for our coasts, such as sea level rise, storm intensification, saltwater intrusion, and coastal erosion.
Barbier was part of a science and engineering board that worked on the 2012 Coastal Master Plan for Louisiana. He says besides addressing the immediate and longer-term impact threats, it contained three important elements.
One is gray infrastructure, the other is green infrastructure, and the third is social infrastructure. Gray infrastructure are the conventional engineered solutions to protecting the coast, such as building seawalls, dikes, and levees, and so forth. The second type of infrastructure is the green infrastructure. There's been tremendous loss of coastal habitats, such as marshes and coral reefs and oyster reefs, due to population change, economic development, and, of course, climate change.
Barbier says there's now an emphasis on revitalizing and restoring this green infrastructure as a natural coastal defense.
And then the third thing that's very important is to involve coastal communities, politicians, stakeholders, business people, and so forth in the design and implementation of these plans. And by building social infrastructure, not only do you improve the capacity of local communities to understand the consequences of not doing these plans and the need for them, but also to gain popular support for this long-term coastal planning strategy.
He says many developing countries do not have such plans in place. Barbier has written a commentary in the journal Nature entitled Hurricane Katrina's Lessons for the World. He proposes that some of the billions of dollars UN member states have allocated for climate adaptation be used for coastal management strategies. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
A new exhibit in Washington is paying tribute to the American flag. It features a wide and eclectic selection of artwork that uses the historic symbol as its central theme. VOA's Julie Tebow has more.
Paintings, wooden sculptures, glowing neon. The exhibit, Stars and Stripes, the American Flag and Contemporary Art, features a diverse collection of art by artists from all across the country in a wide range of mediums.
If you'd like a book, let us know.
Marjorie Goldberg is with the Zenith Gallery, responsible for the exhibit.
You know, I really like Gavin Sewell's work. You know, it's very unique, three-dimensional mixed media. And, you know, the realism ones like Mark Daly and Scott Royston are extraordinary. And then there's the whimsical ones of Anita Kunz. That's a Mona Lisa with the American flag. And Keith Norvell is very humorous. So, you know, really every one of them has their own unique look to them.
For artist Laura Taylor, a U.S. military veteran, the theme is personal.
Because I've done so much work with different veterans, it's very important to me and my mission to be able to give back to the veterans as they have all given to me.
Artist Catherine Owens was also inspired by a personal connection.
My neighbor, Sam, and his wife, Nicole, were both Iraq vets, and he was an Afghan vet. I asked him if I could do an artwork of his boots, and he agreed to that. When he came over to the house to see it in progress, he was able to run his hand over the toes of the boots, and he looked at me and he said, "Catherine, That is exactly the way my boots felt when I was in Iraq and had that very, very fine sand all over my boots. And even today, it gives me the shivers and brings tears to my eyes every time I tell the story.
While nostalgia and patriotism were common themes in the exhibit, visitor Stephen Shore pointed out that there were also images that represented some of America's darker moments.
So it's a delicate balance of highlighting what is best in America, American ideals, and yet artists should feel perfectly free to express those times in our history where we've fallen short of those ideals.
But for Chamber President Harry Wingo, it was all good.
Whenever I look at an American flag, I still get a chill. And, you know, to have us put this this exhibit on at the D.C. Chamber is something that I just couldn't be more proud and more excited about.
Julie Tabo, VOA News, Washington.
That's it for this edition of International Edition. You can get more news and information on our website at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. I'm Ray Kugel in Washington. Enjoy the day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
70 years ago this month, the victors of the Second World War, horrified by crimes committed by the Nazi regime, issued a decree for the prosecution of three crimes: crimes against peace, war crimes, and crimes against humanity. The decree, now known as the Nuremberg or London Charter, established that perpetrators of murder, extermination, enslavement, deportation, and other inhumane acts committed against the civilian population before or during the war could not hide behind their official position in government, nor their obedience to orders from above, to avoid criminal responsibility for participating in such horrendous acts. Since then, these principles have served as the basis for successive provisions on war crimes and crimes against humanity in the statutes of international hybrid and domestic tribunals that have charged and prosecuted hundreds of individuals, from the foot soldier all the way up to the head of state, for such crimes. The International Criminal Tribunal for the former Yugoslavia indicted 161 people for crimes against humanity, war crimes, and genocide committed during the Balkan Wars in the 1990s. Including former Serbian President Slobodan Milosevic and other political and military leaders. Similarly, the International Criminal Tribunal for Rwanda indicted 93 individuals accused of being responsible for the 1994 Rwandan genocide, including dozens of political and military officials. And in Sierra Leone, a special hybrid court convicted, among others, former Liberian President Charles Taylor for his role in aiding, abetting, and planning atrocities committed by rebels in the civil war there. At one point, these individuals may have believed that they would never have to answer for their crimes. They might have felt justified when perpetrating atrocities because their actions were part either of government policy or of a wide practice that was tolerated or condoned by the government. But no one is above the law. From sexual violence in eastern Congo to the brutal torture in the Assad regime's prisons in Syria, we will continue to seek accountability for the world's worst crimes, wrote Secretary of State John Kerry on the occasion of the 70th anniversary of the London Charter. Such accountability is a stabilizing force in international affairs, and it is what our values and the memory of the victims demand.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.